Colonel Christopher looked at Hartunian, studied his face for the first time. Soft brown eyes, she noticed. He doesn't look like a warrior. Not at all. But she crooked a finger at him and said, "Come on to the galley with me, Mr. Hartunian." He looked surprised for a flash of a second, then unstrapped his harness and rose to his feet. The plane bucked slightly, and he reached for the console to steady himself. "We're not out of the woods yet," said Colonel Christopher, with a thin smile. "I guess not," replied Hartunian shakily. Once they entered the cramped little galley, Christopher went straight to the coffee urn. There was only half a mugful left, dregs. Still, it was better than nothing. She cradled the mug in both hands. Turning back to Hartunian, she said, "Now what about this saboteur?" The engineer looked surprised. "What about him?" "We've got to find out who he is, and why he tried to scratch this mission, Mr. Hartunian." "Harry." Christopher ignored his request for informality as she sipped at her coffee. It was bitter and only lukewarm, and full of grounds. The colonel repeated, "Which one of your people tried to ruin this mission, Mr. Hartunian?" The Pentagon. Situation Room. General Scheib scowled at the blank screen of his laptop. He was getting audio from Able One, but no imagery. And now the audio was giving him trouble. "What do you mean she's not available?" he grumbled into his lip mic. A moment's hesitation while his demand was relayed through a military communications satellite orbiting some 22,000 miles above the equator. Then Captain O'Banion's voice came through the plastic bud that Scheib had jammed in his left ear. "She's not in the cockpit, sir. She's taken a break." "Did you tell her who's calling?" "Yes, sir, I did, sir. She said she'll call you back shortly, sir." The young man's voice sounded clearly troubled. Scheib clenched his teeth together, then growled, "I want her on this frequency right away, mister. Do you understand that?" "Yes, sir." From down at the far end of the table, Zuri Coggins watched the grim expression of Scheib's face. More bad news, she wondered. But the general leaned back in his chair, wormed the butt out of his ear, and simply sat there glaring at his laptop's blank screen. General Higgins was at the coffee cart again. Coggins glanced at a wristwatch and realized with a shock of surprise that it was after 9 p.m. "We've been in this room for nearly 10 hours," she said to herself. "The president's due to start his speech in San Francisco right about now." The speech had been scheduled for the evening news hour so that the network and cable TV shows could carry it live. But with all the commercial commsats off the air, there could be no coast-to-coast TV coverage. Even radio would be spotty. That nuclear blast in orbit had rattled long-range radio transmission, too. Something about high-energy electrons in the ionosphere. Sitting beside her, Michael Jamil had an expression of impending doom on his thinly bearded face. Trying to cheer him up, Coggins leaned toward him and said, "Relax, it's all over." Jamil shook his head. "The missile threat is ended, but this isn't over. Not yet."
"What do you mean?"
"What's China's next move?" Jamil asked urgently.
"You mean North Korea's next move," said Coggins.
"China," he insisted. "China's behind this. The DPRK didn't have the resources to do this on their own, or the nerve. Maybe if Kim Jong-il was still alive, he was nutty enough to try a stunt like this. But not now. Pyongyang doesn't have any motivation to start a nuclear war."
"How can you be sure?" Coggins asked. "History takes weird turns, you know."
Jamil shook his head. "There's always a motivation, no matter how weird it looks at the time.